welcome everybody to the Wildlife Committee of the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission. We have a very packed agenda today, so I am going to delve right in with welcome to all the commissioners and staff who are here, who will be presenting, and also welcome to the attendees. This will be a discussion among staff and commissioners today on a number of topics. We will not be taking testimony from the attendees, but I certainly are glad to have you listening in. So with that, well, as I said, we'll delve right into the agenda, and we have a topic that actually has been brewing for a while. The ADA committee of the commission, this is our only official advisory committee, sent us a resolution a while back about a disability point or points, hunt points for disabled individuals, and a change that took place in 2010. I know staff has met with the committee regarding this issue. That the resolution, which is in our packets, asked the commission to engage with staff on this issue and maybe make a decision about it. So some options are going to be presented to us today. And I think it's Mick who's going to take the lead on this. And he's put together some thoughts as well. So Mick Cope, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Commissioner, and good morning, Commission. It's nice to see you this fine day. Thanks for the introduction there, Commissioner Tharburn. Real quickly, I'm just going to share my screen just in case not everybody has that particular memo or the memo that came from the ADA committee handy. There's, I'm assuming that was, that you can probably see that.
Got it, Mick.
So there's, the paragraph in the middle, it kind of outlines their concern. And I will go into that a little bit more, but this was what it looked like. And it just asked for the commission to investigate the issue. Then I'm going to switch from doing that. If I can get my screen to work. Stop sharing. All right, and then share a different screen. So in your packets today, there or in the information available even on online is this document, which put together to help summarize the issue. In that memo, the ADA Advisory Committee had been discussing how special permit points were allocated. And just a brief note about special permit points. These are points that hunters who apply for special permits, and currently there are, I think, six different categories, and I'll just use some examples. There are quality bull hunts, there's bull hunts, there's antlerless elk hunts, there's hunters with disability hunts, there's youth hunts, and all of whenever a hunter applies for one of those hunts, they get a point, and if they get drawn, their points go away. And that's all described in rule. And if you don't get drawn, then you accumulate points through the years that you don't get drawn. Until you get drawn, then your points go away. So back in 2010, the agency was going through a change in our licensing system. And as part of that, we also changed from, at the time, you could apply for an elk, you could apply for elk as a category, And then you had choices, you chose kind of within that which hunts you wanted to apply for. And some of them were antlerless, and some of them were bulls, and some of them were disabled. But in 2010, we switched to having all these different categories that you could apply for. So you didn't necessarily, because at the time, if you applied for an antlerless permit, say, and you drew it, you lost all of your points that you may have been hoping to use for a bull permit. So you were needing to really kind of choose. At this point, you can choose and accrue points in all of these different categories. And so in 2010, when we made this switch over, hunters at the time had points in the different categories. They had points in elk and they had points in deer. And that was the only kind of, that's as fine as the sand got. When the change was made in 2010, there was a decision made through a commission action in rule that said all points that somebody had in one of those categories, deer or elk, got distributed in each of the new pots, all six pots. So if I personally had 6 points, which I don't, in elk, then I got 6 points in every category that included quality elk or bull elk or antlerless, and also hunters with disabilities and 65 and over, even though I'm not over 65, master hunter, even though I'm not a master hunter. So the reason that was done led to, it was primarily a couple of reasons. One, it was going to be a very difficult task to contact over 150,000 hunters and ask them how they wanted their points distributed amongst the different pots of that were available now. So as kind of an efficient way to go about business, that was done. And then that was kind of backed up by the fact that programming that was required in the new system was going to be pretty complicated to pull off, moving points from one place to another. It was just much more efficient to just kind of spread the peanut butter and move forward. So that idea was put forward through the public process and through commission rule. Then in the document, there's a link to that rule. It's 220.412.080. And specifically, I'm going to give you a little bit of whiplash because I'm going to zip down to the highlighted portion that talks about this. And it talks about that the point totals immediately prior to the sales of the 2010 permit applications will be replicated across all categories. And that will only occur in 2010. And that applicants for any new category in the future would begin would begin with zero, basically, if the new category showed up. So that rule was put in place in 2010. And it's been kind of retained in the system since then. And so as people have been moving through time and turned 65 or had an unfortunate something happened and became disabled or went through and became master hunters, they ended up having some number of points perhaps in their system or in the system under their name. And since we did do the point system prior to 2010 from 1996, if somebody had just horrible luck and didn't draw anything in the elk category during that time, they could have had up to 13 points. I don't know how very many there are of those, but it's a possibility. And they also could have had one. But as people move forward in time, there have been people since 2010 that have turned 65 that have ended up with points in their category. There have been people that have become disabled and they've had points in that category. One thing that was maybe a bit of confusion was one thing, and I put it in the last bullet here, was that those points that people have been gaining over time in the current system, whether it's quality bull, which is really hard to get drawn for, they may have had 20 points and then became disabled or turned 65. Those points don't roll over into the system with them. Those stay. It's only something that was in place before 2010. So With that background, I'm going to pause for a second, Commissioner, and see if there's any questions. I've been talking for a little bit.
Any questions from commissioners or considerations? Next point is the questions for consideration. Obviously, the ADA committee looking at this has raised it, I think, really as a fairness issue. When I first saw it, it sort of struck me the same way, but it's pretty complex if we think through. There are the three different categories, and so it really needs some discussion and thought from us. So, Jim.
Just kind of trying to get dialed in here a little bit. I think I don't, as a hunter, I haven't worked the or played the points game. It's kind of those people that have worked this through, purchasing of permits and the raffles and all that. They know exactly what they've been accumulating, what they've got, what the goals are, and those kinds of things. So, I'm looking to try to get a sense for how many numbers are out there, what kind of risk we're talking about, how much of this tapers off over time. Given the fact that some of these were, they were grandfathered in as being accumulated differently now, et cetera. So I don't have a sharp question, but I guess I'm looking for a little bit more idea about what we're looking at here.
Nick, do you want to talk a little? I see John has his hand up, but do you want to go ahead and talk a little bit about what we know, what we don't know?
You bet. I did do a little bit of work to try and figure out, do we have like hard numbers that I can bring to the table? And it's just a little bit more complicated than that to pull that data from our system. And I can get there if I get a little time, and that's the direction we wanted to go to. So I don't want to say I can't get it, but it wasn't easily available. What I was able to get is that, at the time in 2009, when this transition was made, there were thousands of people who had points in the system. And so, over the last 10 years, certainly some of those folks have been tracking that. And points, folks may or may not know, but hunters in general feel and have a high affinity for their points. And they are something that are very valuable. The opportunities that are available through the special permit system are special. They're special for a reason. In many cases, increased opportunities, increased hunting times, increased chances of being successful. And that applies with the hunters with disabilities, in some cases very specifically, because there are those opportunities in that category lend themselves most to for those hunters to be successful. So understand that probably, I think the word I was able to get is somewhere around 400 people become eligibles, quote unquote, in the hunters with disability category every year. Not every one of those 400 people applies for special permits, and certainly not every one of them have points that have residual from 2009. So we would need to do quite a bit more digging and mining of data to get to a specific number that would that would kind of shed some light on that. But in general, that hopefully that gives a little bit of more context for you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
And if, also before Don, Nick, you met with the Disabilities Committee. Is there anything that you want to characterize from your conversation with them in terms of the perspective as you understood them?
You bet. You know, I really did appreciate getting the opportunity to meet with that committee. Very dedicated individuals representing a group of folks for the committee, you know, and advising the commission. They've been interested in this this specific issue probably for maybe two and a half years, and have been talking about that within their committee. And then in 2019, did write that memo. They're very concerned that folks that do become disabled end up with points coming into that category and feeling like they didn't they weren't qualified for those points to begin with. And I think that, you know, that makes, I can certainly wrap my head around that. That seems like folks have some increased chances of being drawn for some, for hunts when they weren't necessarily investing in that particular thing all along. And it kind of just goes back to, and we talked about the fact that it was, you know, back in 2009 and why the decision was made at the time. And so I was able to kind of walk through that. And we actually had Brock Haynes, our Deer and Elk section manager, also met with the committee and talked about this same topic. So I would say they're very committed and very passionate about the scenario, and would, you know, really appreciate the commission's consideration.
Thanks. So Don, you had your hand up, and I see Barbara's hand up. So Don first.
Yeah, thank you. Those last two questions and answers covered my situation, so I'm good. Thanks.
Okay. Sorry. Barbara.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Thorburn. Mick, is this an unforeseen consequence of the rule change in 2010, or did the commission at the time anticipate that this would still be an issue 10 years later and have a position on that one way or the other?
It's a really good question, Commissioner Baker. I was in Game Division in 2010, but I wasn't in a position working with the permits in with Deer and Elk. I don't know the answer of what the commission was discussing at the time. I did talk with the previous Game Division manager, and who's now retired. He shared with me that, you know, the discussion was pretty robust. There was consideration about the different ways to go about it, and it was just a policy decision at the time that, you know, they were looking at the different kind of cost versus benefit ratio at the time, and how to actually implement it and do it within the time frame that we were trying to put in the new system. So. I'm sorry, I don't have a lot more background than that.
Lorna? You're muted, Lorna. Yeah.
I'm always a little slow to get my cursor to that unmute button. So in reading the summary online, I'm a little confused. So it says that in 2010, that rule changed, that points were distributed even if hunters didn't qualify for the category at the time. It sounds to me like they put in for the category. You know, obviously they weren't selected, but they got the points even though they weren't disabled, they weren't under 60, 65, they weren't a master hunter. Was that kind of a glitch in the system, or why was that the case?
And I'm sorry, Commissioner, I had some internet connectivity issues here. Let me try and restate your question and see if I'm correct.
Okay, do you have in front of you that summary of current state? So if you look at that second bullet point, it says points were distributed even if hunters didn't qualify for the category at the time. Weren't a master hunter, weren't under 65, et cetera. So I'm wondering how that happened. Was that, you know, was that intended to be the case or, and if so, why was that?
It was, and a couple of points further down in the document, this was done primarily for two reasons. That's kind of the two most important points about what was being considered at the time, that it was going to be, so hunters had it, you know, there's around 150,000 hunters that would need to be contacted to say, you had 3 points and where would you like your 3 points put, in which bucket? And the kind of the process to get there, you know, to make that happen, the administrative burden that was, they took that into account. They took into account that the system at the time that we were working in, with our licensing system, needed specific kinds of programming, and to do some pretty high level kind of programming that would do things in a different way was going to take quite a bit of time and money.
Got it. Okay.
The two of those things combined led the charge to say, well, if we just kind of spread the peanut butter here, that'll be the most effective way to get there.
I heard you say spread the peanut butter. Oh, sorry, Kim.
I was back up a little bit further, Lorna. And so before this system was put in place in 2010, there were only two categories to get points in. It was the species categories. So in 2010, these new categories were created, the disabled under 65 master hunter.
Okay.
So that's what led to this distribution.
Thanks, Kim.
Okay, so I'm not seeing any other hands. So what we need to make a recommendation to the commission about what we want to do proceeding with this.
Commissioner?
Ideas, it's a little bit more complicated, I think, than it looks on its face in terms of the fairness question. But what do you think, Jim? I see your hand.
Well, a couple of thoughts. One is the issue of being vested and whether or not the department, what authority the department would have to change those rules, take away those points. That's one thought. Then the other one is a thought about a voluntary kind of action on the part of some who may realize that it was just because of the calculation, not necessarily because they were in those categories at the time and may want to forego those. I don't know if that buys you anything, but just wondering if that has been looked at. So those two thoughts.
That's the latter thought is interesting, given that going forward from 2010, if you had points and changed categories, you start from the beginning. So you know, bringing that forward in a voluntary way might be interesting.
Commissioner?
Yes. Mick, did you want to say something?
Thank you. And I appreciate the creative thought, Commissioner Anderson. I just wanted the committee to know that I did have a conversation with the AG's office about kind of what are we looking at here and what would it take. We were in the same spot about, you know, that this would take a rule change. to make some change in people's points. That word about that I used in this document is talking about hunters being vested is similar to what Commissioner Anderson was talking about, and in that people have a feel, you know, they will feel there are people that would feel like they have a right to have points that have been in there because of a rulemaking. And so it would, you know, I would advise, you know, the commission to kind of keep all of those pieces in mind as considering moving forward. It certainly can be done, but it would be through a rulemaking process.
So, committee, is this, Joe, I'll let you weigh in, and then I see Barbara. Yes, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Thorburn, and all their commissioners. There, you know, depending upon what actions the commission would choose to take on this, there could potentially be a litigation risk if some people who did lose points felt aggrieved. And because of that potential risk, there are some aspects of legal advice that would be suitable for an executive session to discuss those legal risks and help inform your options. But again, that would be best either offline or in executive session.
Thank you, Joe. Barbara?
This is another question for Mick. Does staff have a recommendation on this issue?
Mick, did you hear the question?
Commissioner Thorburn, this is Eric. I guess I'm not sure if we lost Mick's audio there for a little bit. You're back. Okay. The question was, do we have a recommendation? We do not have a formal recommendation at this time. I think what we're really just identifying the problem, make sure it's well understood, understand that we really do have this question in front of us. There are some legal issues, and you know, I think if the commission decided this was worth pursuing, then we would, you know, look at the legal issues and we'd be in a better place to come up with a formal recommendation of if it should actually be done or not. But Mick, weigh in if I didn't quite characterize that correct.
Yeah, I apologize. I am having internet connectivity issues, but I think you're right, Eric.
Great, thank you, Mick. Jim?
Yeah, I guess it boils down, I mean, I'm not sure where I'm at on this, but I think I could get to a decision easier if I had a better idea on numbers. You know, I think, are we looking at a significant impact on opportunity in these categories by retaining the present approach? Or are we looking at really an insignificant thing? And then are there other ways that maybe in terms of the solution, whether there can be a, you know, some kind of balancing or some kind of weighted points going forward or something? And maybe that's just getting too complicated there, but I guess my first point is trying to really understand the numbers and consequently then the risk into each of these categories. Otherwise, we're just kind of making a decision that isn't particularly well-informed.
Thanks, Jim. So Eric, I see your hand up. Molly, I also see yours, but I'm assuming Eric wants to respond to Jim's point. So Eric?
Thank you. Yeah, and Mick, I'll ask you to help me here, but Commissioner Anderson, to your question, I recall part of Mick's presentation that there were approximately 150,000 hunters in the system at the time. And then, so at that time, those were hunters with points. So at that time in 2010, if I'm following this right, whatever points those people had in the system would have been distributed to these categories. So over time, some of those people have stopped hunting, left the state, perhaps turned 65 already or become disabled. But I think what we're talking about is something in that realm of whatever is in that 150,000, that something hasn't already happened to kind of use the points or resolve the issue. The remainder resides with this situation. It's not me. I wasn't here there at the time, but if that had been me, what that would mean is I would still be sitting on those points if I had them distributed. And if I became disabled, I would then have those points available in the current system. And hopefully I'm gonna survive and get to 65. And when I get to 65, that distribution of those points would then apply to me. So we can do more work. And again, I'm hoping I'm not speaking too far out of turn, but Commissioner Anderson, I think that's kind of where we're at, is that initial 150,000 subtracting any situation that would have removed a portion of that count because something's happened that's something's transpired to utilize those points or to you know essentially remove it from the equation.
So those 150,000, were those hunters that were hunting or were those hunters that had points of some sort or another?
And this is hopefully where I didn't get in trouble, Mick.
Yeah. I think we will need to do some work to get actual numbers for you, Commissioner, but the number of 150 was a pretty general number. It was the number of people that it was an approximation of the number of people that had points at the time, not necessarily the hunters that were active that year. So I think we would just need to do some more digging, and I've already queued up our licensing division to be able to provide that information. We just couldn't get there this quickly.
Thanks, Mick. Molly?
Well, Eric answered a lot of my questions already, but I don't know if it's, I've finally been on the commission long enough, but to identify these things, but this, at first glance, I was like, oh, this seems easy. And then it's like, the more you dig into it, this gets incredibly complex, incredibly quickly. And so I just would like to be thoughtful about how we proceed on this. And I really do want to hear what council has to say about this, because I think I can certainly see some tricky legal issues that could be around this. So, and then my other point would be is, you know, I just don't want to do anything that makes anything unduly complicated. If we can avoid that, I think it's already a pretty complicated system, and I don't want to discourage any user groups either by any decision we make. So just if we can be thoughtful through this, I think it's an interesting topic.
So being attentive to our long agenda, here's what I'm hearing and how I think we should move forward. We will ask for legal advice or counsel, and that will be to the entire commission in an executive session. I think before we bring the rest of it before the commission, we need some more information to help decide whether we think it should be something considered by the entire commission. So. Numbers, parsing some of the information that you've already been able to pull. One area that I was thinking of, Mick, that might be doable is looking at the average of 400 people per year who move into the disability category. If we could backtrack on that and learn what, you know, if there's sort of a range of proportion of those who are carrying forward the points, that might be some useful data if it's doable. It seems like a manageable number if we can pull it. So, but you know, getting that kind of information to us. So we will put this again on our agenda once you're ready with a little bit more data. And ask for legal counsel to prepare a briefing for the commission.
Absolutely, Commissioner, I can work on that, and you know I apologize for not coming with all of that information. I did give it a try, But we will finish that and get back to this. I did want to make sure that, you know, the reason this came up in front of the commission was from the ADA committee, and it was specific about ADA. That is one decision point. I brought in the other components because there are other pieces that are in similar situation, you know, that are similarly situated. And I wanted to make sure the commission had clarity on that.
Yeah, and my feeling is we should look at it over all the groups. It's raised as a fairness issue by one group, but it seems like if we singled it out, moving forward, committee members, nods if you agree with that, or should we single it out as solely for this specific group that's brought it forward to us? Jim?
I think we look at all, but I think we need to recognize that perhaps there are different drivers legally, ADA in particular, that could be different than over 65 or Master Hunter. So, I mean, I'd like to know the range, and then we can make that call based on maybe legal sensitivities, if there are.
Great point, Jim. Thank you. Is that clear enough, Nick?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you for the time today.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. So next we have a potential land acquisition. That sounds very interesting. We got a fact sheet on it. And I'm assuming that Cynthia is going to kick us off. Cynthia Wilkerson from our land division.
Yes, good morning, Commissioner Thorburn, Chair Thorburn. And I would also like to say good morning to the other commissioners. I'm missing the in-person interactions here. But also welcoming new commissioners Smith and Kuntz. So nice to see you this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
I have with me today Brian Calkins, who's our Region 6 Regional Wildlife Program Manager. And then I wonder if I'm able to share my screen. Yes, I am. I'm gonna do that in just a minute. Thanks for a little bit of time on what I know is a jam-packed agenda. We're here to kind of preview one of the big projects that's going to come to you in the Lands 2020 cycle. Next commission meeting in February. Some of you know we have an annual cycle for considering whether or not potential acquisitions are a good match for DFW. It's a director's decision about whether or not to commit to move forward and pursue grant funding in the actual end stage of acquiring the lands. It is commission decision to acquire the land. So those come to you most months, actually. But I think we also do not have any this month, no land transactions for you. However, so in the cycle of this annual Lands 2020, we have six projects, but there's one that's quite significant, and we just wanted to give you a little preview. So I'm sharing my screen. Can you give me a thumbs up, Chair Thorburn, if you can see it?
I see it.
Okay, great. So we are talking about, this is a very exciting opportunity in Western Washington, Thurston County and Lewis County. This is the Centralia Mine proposal project. It's nearly 10,000 acres. We have had this on our radar for quite a few years, an interest for long-term value for public access and conservation. Lots of really exciting opportunity that Brian will speak in detail about, but wanted to bring this to your attention. They are actually looking to donate about two-thirds of it to us, kind of right off the bat. So it's a pretty phenomenal opportunity. And clearly we have lots to think about and discuss with regards to O&M. And we know that there's lots of interest in the property tax and local property tax implications. But I will let Brian give kind of the overview. We'll let you know sort of what we're hearing so far in terms of feedback and see if you have any questions. So Brian, I think with that, I'll have you walk people through the map and the values and where we're at.
Yeah, thanks, Cynthia, and thank you, commissioners, for having us here today. So I guess the first thing I would say is that project that's been talked about for a really long time amongst field staff. I recently talked to a retired employee who claimed that people were talking about this in the 1970s, but things got really more serious about a dozen years ago and really ramped up about a year and a half or 2 years ago when TransAlta made the decision that they wanted to work with us as a purchaser or future owner of the mine. They felt like that was an exciting opportunity, and we definitely see it that way as well. And this is a really unique opportunity. I can't imagine where something like this might be possible in another place in Western Washington to really restore high quality wildlife habitats. We're looking at wetlands, grasslands, forests, and potentially a habitat for listed species, including Western pond turtle, Oregon spotted frog, and streak-horned lark. There's elk on the property. At last count or estimate, up to 400 elk, and they're a key feature of the landscape, widely known. And this is an area that currently is only open through permit, kind of connecting to the last topic, to disabled hunters and senior hunters. And the reason for that is currently because of mining permitting requirements, they have to be escorted onto the mine due to safety reasons. But reclamation, mining stopped in about 2006, if I remember correctly. Reclamation has continued up to this point in time. And reclamation was pointed towards virtually the entire mine being put back into a condition as a commercial forest. We've been working with them on changes to the reclamation plan, which would leave more areas in open grasslands. It would keep some really high quality wetlands in place that otherwise they would have been required to remove. We and TransAlta are both working with the Federal Office of Surface Mines on those changes. I think it's fair to say that to this point, they're looking at that favorably. Obviously, an area like this, and it's close to a number of what we would call urban centers, has a tremendous amount of recreational potential for people to hunt, fish, or just connect with nature and carry on family traditions. Access to forest lands, as I'm sure you know, and land in general for recreation in Western Washington is becoming more and more limited. And one of the reasons that we really feel like this is a project that we should pursue. Another kind of driving factor for both us and TransAlta is to really showcase how impacted lands can be reclaimed and enhanced for the benefit of fish, wildlife, and obviously people as well. The reclamation standards that we're working on and kind of the general theme that we get from the Office of Surface Mining, the overarching standard is that the land needs to be back in a condition as good as or better than it was prior to mining. I can attest, you know, getting out there is somewhat limited, but we'd love to have some of you out to actually see the site once that becomes possible. And I don't mean when reclamation is complete. I'm talking about our current restrictions related to COVID. But it's a great place. You really have to see it to appreciate it and get excited about it.
I'm sorry. I think Cynthia is looking to share a screen. I just wanted to make sure she knew that that was popping up everywhere.
I wondered what happened.
I do. I'm sorry. My multiple screens. I'm trying to pull up another document to speak from in a minute, but I think I'm good. Sorry about that.
Brian, thank you. There are a couple of hands up. Jim, is your hand still up or do you have something?
It is not up, but I probably will have something, so I will forego and come back.
Okay. Lorna. Lorna, unmute.
Yep.
There you go.
Always slow off mark on that. I am really, really excited about this project for a whole lot of reasons. When I met with Larry Phillips recently, we went over it, and I just think that this has the potential to be a showcase, not just for the department and regionally, but maybe even nationally for how you do these reclamation projects, because there's a lot of old mine sites like this, and the existing requirements for restoring to the former condition might seem like a good idea, but you know, these, in many cases, the surface water features have been allowed to, you know, kind of naturalize over numbers of years, and, you know, to fill them in again and restore it to forest isn't necessarily a benefit to anybody or any wildlife. So I'm really excited about this project, and I want to get on the ground down there and see it for myself when I can. So thumbs up for me on this, you know, proceeding ahead.
Thanks, Lorna. Molly?
Yeah, I apologize. I didn't have the time to do a little bit of my own homework on this. My question is, what kind of mining operation was it? Which leads to my second question is there any concerns about what I would call dirty dirt on this and like in that maybe coming back around to biting us in the keister in the future? I'm just a little bit I'm just wondering about that.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the things that we're working with the Office of Surface Mines on, is that's obviously one of their requirements, is that any contaminants are mitigated or removed, I think is a good general way to state it. And actually there is one area and perhaps we can walk around the map here in a little bit, where TransAlta has kept one area, Cynthia's pointing at it, out of the transaction, because that is an area where they have some testing requirements that continue on for quite a number of years. We're not, to this point, really concerned about it. I will say that I've had one conversation with Department of Ecology, and expecting to follow up with them on a couple of different issues, including the one you brought up. But right now, we don't have any concern at all that's come up that would cause us concern.
Thanks. Barbara?
Thanks, Kim. Molly, TransAlta was a great big coal mine, just to answer your first question. And again, this is my day because everything we're talking about is in my backyard, and I have spent a ton of time down there. It is an amazing property to have the opportunity to have somebody give it to us. And aside from the benefits of habitat and recreation, the other thing that I'm excited about this is that it is sort of in between, it's in a valley in between two, they're certainly not mountain ranges, but hill ranges where there's sections and sections of undeveloped property. And so this thing has a big old potential for connectivity for our, for the animals that, you know, do their migrations. And so I want to just, I mean, I guess there's, we have more to see on this, but I'd like to just weigh in happily and favorably as soon as possible.
Jim?
Yes, a couple of thoughts. One is obviously this is a quite an opportunity, and they don't come around like this often. So, you know, this is good. I've got a couple of thoughts. One is you know, these donations are rarely done entirely with magnanimously or without strings. And so I guess the sharp pencil or the critical eye here is going to be really important. I'm sure that that's in front of you, and I would encourage that kind of hard-nosed thinking here, because I've just seen where in different places, there's oftentimes an attempt to shift burdens and not have the responsibilities. And I don't want to see operations that made certain promises walk away from them, you know, unless it's very duly considered and legal and that kind of thing. So specifically a couple thoughts. One is this is in the Chehalis system. We've got quite a dust up on Olympic Peninsula steelhead and steelhead in general on the coast, and the Chehalis system is a big part of that. And so I think this could be really helpful in the long term with that, and it may have a tie in to Chehalis Basin planning stuff that I'm not real dialed into, but I know is being still considered in the different processes, including the legislature. And then finally, and I'm broken record on this, is a payment in lieu of taxes and the impact that the department has acquiring this property and what it may do in terms of revenue base. And I think it's important, just as it is important on the east side, that that this be recognized and an understanding reached in, you know, so that we don't have surprises and opposition and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so if,
Fred, if I could. Oh, and okay.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I should have raised my hand.
No, it's okay. I should have let you in.
I think I'll address your first concern and maybe let Cynthia talk about the property tax and PILT portion of it. If it's summary assurance over the past year, we've had two teams of people working on this. One of them is a technical team that we put together to work with TransAlta to kind of inventory what's out there, work on changes to reclamation. And the other one is a policy team that has been working on the higher level outreach, understandings that we need to make with the company. In both of those groups, that critical eye is there. And I hope that provides a little bit of reassurance.
Yeah, and I would just add, local government needs to be brought in right away. We've got a lot more on the agenda, and there's still hands up. So I would like to get this wrapped up. So try to keep things brief. Fred?
Can I address quickly that I'm sorry, piece?
Yeah.
Commissioner. And we are actively outreaching to local and state officials, government officials. Tom McBride is actively engaged in our policy team as well. So that's all going quite well. For the payment in lieu of taxes, Lewis and Thurston County do not currently opt into PILT, which is something they would have to do. But if they did, then we would have the ability to get the funding from the legislature to pay what we would owe in that case. And then we are looking at the ramifications based on currently what the agreement is for property taxes that TransAlta is paying right now. As you can imagine, for such a large place, it's not exactly the same as, you know, you and I paying our property taxes.
Thanks, Cynthia. Fred, did you want to?
Right. I don't know if you can hear me. I tried to put my hand back down, but so I'll be very brief. First of all, I just share the enthusiasm. I think it's a great project. And I'm new to the commission, so I'm still trying to figure out certain things. And it was my understanding that land acquisition costs had to be provided by grants. And so I'm wondering if there are any land acquisition, I know it's a donation, but are there any land acquisition costs? And I know, you know, having been in the fundraising business, you know, how likely is it that we're to get the grant in a reasonable amount of time? And could there ever be exceptions to that rule through legislative lobbying?
Before staff jumps in, Fred, that is not a brief question. It's coming, the whole process will be brought before us at the February meeting when we go through the lands 2020. So perhaps we could ask Jeff to get with you to talk a little bit about that, but you'll have a pretty intense briefing on the whole process at the February meeting. So if you don't mind, I'd sort of like to keep this going and let you get that information as it comes. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure, of course.
Okay, Molly?
So quickly, I appreciate what Jim said, his cautious feelings around a mining company being generous by giving land away. I share those concerns. I understand the excitement around this piece of property, but when I look at it, I know how expensive it is to manage land, and so acquiring it is just one part of it. This looks like a concern as far as managing it into the future, having the funds to do that. But I'm excited about the connectivity of it. I'm excited about, so I don't want to be a wet blanket, but I feel cautious about this just based on how clean the site is going to be and the money it's going to take to maintain it through time.
Thanks, Molly. So I think we'll wrap this up. Tongue in cheek, Brian, I think you're going to have to put in an airstrip if you're planning on street corn larks. They seem to like the airfields in the prairies.
We're actually looking to try to create something just like that.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Cynthia and Brian. We look forward to more on this. Appreciate it. And I think we're staying in the lands division and moving on to e-bikes. So Cynthia, are you going to kick that off, or are we turning it over to Joel?
Yeah, I'm gonna kick it off, and then he's got a presentation for you. I'm sure have noticed that there's been quite some interest, several communications from the public with regards to the issue of e-bike use on DFW land. So we're moving from the excitement of whether or not to get something new and fresh and exciting to, okay, the reality of management in our lands. And this is one many of you, if not the new commissioners, are aware that we are working on a recreation strategy for our lands. It's long, long, long overdue, and it's a big lift. And so in and amongst this sort of trying to set the stage at the big picture, Joel will take you through the details, but a 2018 regulation law, state law with regards to e-bikes, and the public is expressing their interest and desire on our management with relation to e-bikes. So we're gonna take you through what is currently happening, what the state law says, what other land managers are doing, and what our thoughts are sort of both in the short and long term. We are expecting several voices to speak to this issue in public comment tomorrow morning. So we just thought for you to have this context. Go ahead, Joel. I think you were gonna share. Yeah, you got it going.
Thanks, Cynthia. And good morning, commissioners. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Great. So as Cynthia said, we are getting a number of public comments asking for clarification for our position on e-bikes on DFW managed lands. I think I want to say up front that it's understandable. There's some confusion in the public because, as you'll see as I run through what other land managers are doing, it's kind of all over the place. People have been interpreting both the federal executive order that came out last year, as well as the state law that came out in 2018, quite differently across land managers. So I want to run you through what we're seeing, what we're hearing, and give you a little bit of a primer in time for tomorrow's public comment. So starting with the e-bike definition, it can be a two saddle or it's a two saddle with three wheels or two wheels, and the wattage doesn't exceed 750 watts. There are different kinds. Generally, front hub motors are the ones that have a throttle. Rear hub motors can have a throttle or be pedal assist, and the mid drive are pedal assist. The official classifications for e-bikes fall into three classes. Class one and class three are e-bikes where a person pedals and the motor kicks in to assist the pedaling. And class two is a bike that's equipped with a throttle. So there, a person can be propelled by the motor without human propulsion or without pedaling. And these are the standard classifications that have been accepted in 26 states plus the federal government, including the state of Washington. I did forward a memo to the committee in advance of this meeting, which this presentation is basically a quick summary of that. There's one clarification in that memo that I want to make, and I'll make that toward the end. So in terms of impacts, to be honest, the specific impacts on wildlife and habitat are still TBD. Because it's a relatively new technological advance with bicycles, there's just not a lot of data or research out there yet to draw upon. The one concern we've heard from our land managers, as well as land managers at other agencies, is basically e-bikes provide an opportunity for a greater footprint. People can travel farther, higher, faster with these than they would necessarily under their own steam. So the broader footprint plus the potential impacts with other users, particularly for the class three bikes that can go up to 28 miles per hour. So those are some of the concerns that we're considering. So last year, DOI, Department of Interior, issued Order 3376 and basically directed interior departments to do rulemaking to clarify their policy on e-bikes. It basically said that e-bikes are bicycles and should be treated as non-motorized, but it also left a lot of discretion to the respective agencies, which those agencies have use. It's also not self-executing, meaning that it does not necessarily automatically apply to places where e-bikes are already allowed or not allowed. BLM did their rulemaking associated with this, finished it in 2020. They adopted the definitions and classifications that I already shared with you. They gave local managers the authority to determine where to allow e-bikes following a NEPA review. Bureau of Reclamation, similar. Forest Service, which of course is not an interior agency, it's under Department of Agriculture, has gone similar but important distinction, a different way from the interior departments. Forest Service has adopted the classifications that are offered by the DOI guidance and the basic definitions of electric bikes. But one thing that they have differed from Interior on is they are defining e-bikes as motorized vehicles. And this is still up to the local manager's discretion. And the way that they intend to deal with that is to do essentially a review process associated with every mile of trail, which, you know, God bless the Forest Service, I suspect that will take quite a long time to get through. But the defining them as motorized vehicles also poses the risk of further kind of confusing the public as to where e-bikes are allowed and where other motorized vehicles are allowed or not allowed. This is a summary of Senate Bill 6434, which was passed in 2018. It's basically changed the code in three areas. It adopts the definition classifications, class one, class two, class three. It says that if the local jurisdiction doesn't address e-bikes, then the default is to allow class one and class two bikes, which are, you remember, the ones that go under 20 miles an hour, where other bicycles are allowed. They're not allowed on single track natural surface trails. There's a labeling requirement from retailers and people who rent or deal in electric bikes. And one thing that is important to note that's not on this slide is that public land managers still retain discretion to exclude e-bikes as needed, or as they determine. So DNR and DFW have the most similar practice currently, where we consider e-bikes as motorized and treat them as such, which means that any trail, whether kind of natural surface or otherwise, where motorized vehicles are not allowed, we do not allow e-bikes. But it does mean that roads, et cetera, where motorized vehicles are allowed, would allow e-bikes. DNR is currently involved in a pilot project with EMBA, which is the Evergreen Mountain Bike Alliance. Most of the e-bikes we would see in our lands are motorized mountain bikes. They're doing a pilot outside of Darrington, which would essentially allow e-bikes. It's a new trail system. So part of the rationale is that this would not create conflict with any existing use because the whole trail would be a new system. State Parks has a much, they've essentially decided to allow all pedal assist e-bikes, which is the class one that go up to 20 miles an hour, in the class three, which can go up to 28 miles per hour, anywhere that other bicycles are allowed. And they came to this not through a formal process. It was an internal decision. It's my understanding that it was very much guided by their enforcement's division opinion on what they could or couldn't enforce on parks land based on parks code. So here is where we are at, and basically we would allow e-bikes where motorized vehicles are allowed. We would not allow them where motorized vehicles are not allowed. And this, you know, the second bullet says not allowed on designated non-motorized with natural surface. That's what Senate Bill 6434 says. I would add that we currently don't allow e-bikes either on improved surfaces where motorized vehicles are not allowed. And an example of that would be a Forest Service that's currently closed to public access, because currently we don't allow motorcycles, ORVs, et cetera, on those roads. And that's the clarification I would also make in the memo, that the memo doesn't speak directly to that case where you have an improved surface that's closed to motorized use. DFW's current policy is to not allow motorized vehicles there, which would include e-bikes. Now, we do, like I said, we do sympathize with the public confusion about the different rules related to e-bikes on public lands, and want to clarify, first of all, we need to clarify our current position, and our intention is to make that more explicit on our public materials, including our website. But we also want to continue to think about whether this current practice is the right practice for our lands, consistent with our goals of protecting the resources as well as allowing recreation where possible, or where compatible, I should say. So that longer term process would include a further scan of local regulations and processes. We know that Spokane County, for example, is currently engaged in a process. So it'd be helpful to look at what the comment says in those processes, as well as while we do our own process, which would include talking to our own folks across programs, especially enforcement. And we have begun that process, but it needs to continue. We want to talk to our governmental partners, including the tribes, about what the potential impacts and benefits would be of allowing e-bikes on more roads and trails, and then develop a more formal policy after that process. One opportunity that has come up, EMBA, which I mentioned earlier, has agreed to convene a 6-month process that includes other public land managers, including DFW, as well as other interest groups. We are encouraging and actually insisting that EMBA include hunting groups in that convened process, because that's actually a constituency that we are hearing from, people who are wanting to go hunting on e-bikes on our lands, are part of the group that you'll probably hear from tomorrow. So that, I was talking really fast because I know you're short on time, but I'll take any questions if you want to pose them.
Jim. You're muted, Jim. Jim, muted.
Okay, I'm sorry. This is all pretty confusing with all the double negatives and of course the different state agencies all being across the board. And so I'm going to try to get more educated on this. I think the what it seemed to be missing there on your list of next step forward was a dialogue with other state agencies. I didn't see that as being on there, and maybe your perspective is that there's nothing to be gained or it's intractable, but clearly the public is looking at the state and not just DFW or DNR or parks. And so to the extent that there can at least be clarification there would be helpful. I think that we're going to be judged, by how confused people are on this. And with regard to the hunting issue, I think it goes both ways. You know, I think there is the access, behind gates on bicycles is a part of getting into the high country, if you will, or behind the gates. But if, a motorized, electric bikes are allowed that allow significant increase in activity there, that can affect you know, how well the department can manage the resource as well. So I'm sure we're going to hear from hunters, both pro and con, on the access issue.
Thanks, Jim. Don?
Thanks. Thanks, Madam Chair. Two questions. One has to do with the speed issue. And the question is going to be, how many people on non-motorized motorbikes go 20 miles an hour? I know when I'm driving around in a car, 25 mile an hour speed zone seems kind of slow. On the other hand, when I look at some of these videos of people with non-motorized dirt bikes up and down and around, it looks like some of them are going pretty fast. So do non-motorized dirt bikes that we currently allow everywhere go 20 miles an hour? And my second question is kind of a why question. You had a slide there that said near-term management, which I think you said is our current policy, does not allow non... Well, anyway, why something to do with consistent with Senate bill, something or other, but I thought you said our current policy is no. And so the question is why?
Thank you, commissioners, for those questions. I have a couple. Commissioner Thornburn, should I respond to those first two or do you want to let...
Yes, go ahead.
Commissioner Smith? Okay.
Yeah.
So in terms of the question about conversations, consultation with other government agencies, that is our intention. And I, you know, it's kind of ongoing. I was on the phone with DNR this morning to clarify their position. And the process that EMBA has offered to help convene would include the public land managers. I presume that would also mean Forest Service, most likely, and maybe some of the other federal agencies. So we feel like that's really important. I think the more we can be consistent with, align with our state partners while still being true to our specific mission, we should do that. In terms of the speed question, Commissioner McIsaac, I think that the mountain bikers, I think the pedal assist or the motor assist probably won't dramatically increase speed of these bikes going downhill, because those bikes are probably, at least the ones who are doing mountain biking as a sport, are probably already exceeding 20 miles an hour when they're going downhill. If they're riding a class one or class two e-bike, that would be the same. It wouldn't go any faster than that going downhill. The change will really be the ability to go faster uphill or on straight flat surfaces. The why question as to, you know, what our current position is. And again, I apologize for that slide, because I should have clarified that our position is currently that e-bikes are allowed where motorized vehicles are allowed, but not elsewhere. Senate Bill 6434 basically says that e-bikes are excluded on natural surfaces. The mountain bike community, which helped advise the drafting of that bill, specifically intended to differentiate between electric bikes and mountain bikes. So they wanted to make sure that, unlike in California, single track natural surface trails were not currently available to e-bikes. The pilot project that DNR is doing in Darrington will allow e-bikes on single track dirt trails, but it will be a pilot project and would be signed as such. It doesn't represent a change in DNR's policy elsewhere. So I hope those are helpful clarifications.
Yeah, just to follow up on the why question of our current policy. So if the Senate bill says e-bikes are motorized and should not be allowed where non-motorized bikes are allowed, how does the Parks Department and these other folks get out of that Senate bill constraint?
Well, the Senate bill doesn't define e-bikes as motorized vehicles. It defines them as bicycles. with electric motor assist up to 750 watts. And that Senate bill has written into it a fair bit of discretion for land managers to determine when they should exclude e-bikes from trails, natural or otherwise.
So if we get questions tomorrow in open public testimony that really get to this point of why is the current Department of Fish and Wildlife policy a no? What is the current answer to that for immediately right now?
The current answer is we are not yet clear on what the impacts are of e-bikes across our lands in terms of both, you know, the issues that I have named, which is the increased footprint, as well as the potential for increased speed and conflict. We are, like other agencies, looking at changing that practice, but we want to look at it more closely before we do.
Okay, thank you.
So Molly and Lorna, I see you, but Cynthia has her hand up, so I think she probably wants to make a point to Don.
Yeah. Thanks, Commissioner Garber, and thanks for the question. Really, really key question, Commissioner McIsaac. So the you know, it's not that it's a no, it's that it's no where not where motorized vehicles are not allowed. So there are, you know, plenty of roads, trailed services where motorized vehicles are allowed on DFW lands where e-bikes are currently allowed. The crux that we are hearing about from the public is the lack of clarity. And I completely agree with Commissioner Anderson. This is a brain twister at every turn, and it's a challenge for all of us. We're trying to navigate it. So the piece that is sort of up in the air is, what do you do on unimproved road surfaces? So what is the definition of natural surface? What's the difference between that and, you know, a closed forest road? And, you know, we would like to, before we make any changes, we would like to be able to go through the public process and learn from those conversations, like what EMBA is convening with the various stakeholders. And we do very much see the value in being aligned with other public land managers. As you can see, they are across the board as well. But it's best for all of us to be aligned as much as possible for clarity with the public and clarity. You know, we've got Captain Myers here that's been a part of this critical team that we are working with on this enforceability and all of those things. So it's just a tough one right now. And we are trying to admit that there's not a lot known about the impacts, whether it be safety impacts or conflict impacts or environmental impacts. And we're just trying to start where we are and move forward, but without making any, you know, any changes without public process.
Joel, did you want to add something? And then we'll turn to Molly. I'm trying to be attentive of time, so
yeah, just have really,
one another. Yeah.
Thank you, Commissioner Thorburn. Just really quickly, one of the arguments that you might hear tomorrow is that we need to accommodate people with disabilities who want to use e-bikes as a mobility device. And it's important to note that we do have a process in place through the special use permit process to provide accommodation for that on a case-by-case basis. So that process does exist.
Thank you, Jill. Molly?
Really briefly, I don't really have a dog in this fight, but one thing that pops into my mind as we move forward on this is the market on electric motorcycles, UTVs, and ATVs is really starting to take off. And so as we develop policy around e-bikes, we might want to keep that in mind. On how, you know, it could, because probably people are going to make the connection between the two. And so how we want to think about that going forward.
Thanks, Molly. Yeah. Lorna?
I really kind of wanted to echo a bit what Molly said. And based on my experience in California, where my daughter lives, my four-year-old daughter has an e-bike, for heaven's sake. And, you know, great. I'm glad her parents are giving her that experience and all. She does know how to ride a regular bike. But when I'm on DFW lands, on the lands where non-motorized vehicles only, I mean, where they don't allow motorized vehicles, and I'm hiking or out there, I want that experience. I don't want to be zipped by with a electric bike or a motorbike. You know, I want some of those areas left where you really got to work to get there. And I'm saying that and knowing that as I get older, my ability to do that's going to be limited and I'll be back on the paved roads. But I think I agree with Molly. This is an area that's exploding. I've seen it here where I live on the Olympic Peninsula. I've seen it in California. So if we open this door, we need to be careful that we're not opening it to such a crowd that we've ruined the experience for everybody. So just my initial thoughts.
So thanks, everyone. I Cynthia and Joel, I think you have nailed a number of the issues, and all of the commissioners have recognized that this is pretty complicated. We didn't have a chance to hear from Captain Myers today. I think future discussions, it will be useful to have an enforcement perspective on some of those issues. Safety certainly comes to mind. Look forward to hearing from the public tomorrow. thanks for this. A lot to it.
Thank you.
So with that, this is our Lands Division Day. Cynthia, are you going to introduce Paul and Jeff, or? Okay.
I am, yeah. So from one very challenging new emergent issue to another challenging, not quite emergent issue. This is our grazing program review. We've been in front of you a couple of times of recent. You know, we've been spending several years just really documenting our process. We are working and had public comments on rule change and SEPA comments as well with relation to your Fish and Wildlife Commission policy on grazing, as well as the associated WAC. And we have a couple of new pieces of bodies of work that we are documenting as well and having public comment. So Jeff Burnham has just been doing an incredible job working very diligently through all of that in response to comments. And part of what we wanted, just to give you a bit of a heads up about kind of the order of operations, because we came to you, I believe it was in October, and kind of presented what we were looking at and said, well, we'll come back and ask you for a decision. We are coming in front of the full commission tomorrow, really with taking a little bit of a step back for a couple of reasons. We want to provide a clear overview of our grazing program, where we had kind of dove right into the weeds of exactly, you know, the line by line wording changes and that kind of stuff. So we want to step back and make sure you have the big picture. And we also know, obviously, we have two new commissioners who this is entirely new to. So that is an additional advantage of doing that. We also have a little bit of time with you on a couple of issues next week. So hopefully be able to fill in some gaps. Didn't want to come and ask you to make a decision tomorrow. Additionally, there's just been a lot of work and workload associated with responding to the comments and considering the comments and considering what changes we might make in response to the comments. And then we've had some challenges with the availability and capacity of the AG's office to support us in that process. So that is why we're taking a little more time. And that's why you're going to see what you're going to see tomorrow, which will be followed up by a decision on February 12th. So with that, I'm going to have Jeff kind of walk you through where, you know, what we've heard and where we're at a little more detail.
Thank you, Cynthia. Thank you, commissioners. Good to be talking with you again. As Cynthia said, tomorrow will be a little bit of a big picture update. So you might remember that there are kind of three things in play here. One is some proposed amendments to the section of WAC that deals with grazing on WDFW lands. The second part was the Fish and Wildlife Commission policy that addresses grazing on WDFW lands. And then the third part was a set of guidance and management tools, essentially, that demonstrate how WDFW is implementing those other two things, how we're implementing the policy and the WAC. And so one of the things that we've come to realize over the last couple months is we were not clear enough about the distinction between those things. So whereas tomorrow you'll get more of that big picture update, today, especially for the benefit of the new commissioners, we wanted to zero in on the proposed changes to the WAC and to the commission policy so you can understand what is changing. So the WAC has been around for a long time, the Fish and Wildlife Commission policy a little bit less time. The policy dates from 2002, and I don't think either of those things have been updated in the years since. And we've found that there are areas where they're either inconsistent or they're redundant, and we feel that that's a little bit confusing. The WAC is a binding legal obligation, and it makes sense that the policy would not deviate from that in any way. So, both documents permit grazing under certain circumstances, and as a department, we still do feel that grazing has an important role to play in conserving fish and wildlife in certain areas and under certain conditions. So, one of the things that we're proposing to change is which permits go to the Fish and Wildlife Commission for review. Currently, there's an exception for temporary permits. Now, temporary permits still need to have ecosystem standards assessments performed in association with them, and that would not change. But we do propose to maintain that exception for temporary permits, which can last for up to a year. We would also propose to maintain an exception for renewal. But the amendments would clarify that a renewal would apply to any permit that's been active within the last 10 years. And a big reason for that clarification is that is the period of time associated with SEPA exemptions. So the part of WAC that deals with SEPA clarifies that state grazing leases, so this would be DNR or DFW, are exempt from SEPA threshold determinations if they've been active within the last 10 years. And then the final piece, which is a little bit new, we would clarify that WDFW could issue a grazing permit on acreage that's newly acquired. So, for example, if you remember the Big Bend acquisition, or we've had a couple of acquisitions in Assotin County, the department chose to issue grazing permits on that land. And so what we would add to WAC is the clarification that those permits could apply for up to 3 years following acquisition. At that point, if we wanted to renew one of those grazing permits, it would need to come before the commission for review. And that part is just not clear right now. And we think that even if grazing has been occurring on a newly acquired piece of land for a long time, which is typically the case, it still is new to the department and new to the commission and bears that extra investigation and examination. I mentioned temporary permits. So those are already defined in WAC. They exist, they have existed, and we would continue to have the possibility of issuing a temporary permit for up to a year. There is a section in the WAC that talks about grazing management plan content. Most of our permits have grazing management plans. Most of our temporary permits have grazing management plans. But there is currently an exception for those permits that last less than 2 weeks. Those are usually crossing permits, and a grazing management plan is often overkill in that situation. We would like to be able to issue grazing permits without management plans. For permits that might last longer than 2 weeks in terms of the overall real-time window, but that have grazing on WDFW lands for fewer than 14 days. And that allows us some operational flexibility when we don't know exactly when a crossing might take place, for example. We just know that it will take place. And then the final amendment to WAC is that WAC currently specifies a number of actions that can be taken upon expiration of a permit. So you could go to auction, you could simply renegotiate with an existing permittee, but discontinuing that grazing permit is not currently defined in WAC. And a number of people felt pretty strongly that that was something that we needed to be able to do, is to discontinue a permit without necessarily showing damage. We don't expect that this would be used with any great frequency at all, but it is in there. So that is that summarizes the changes that we're proposing to WAC. The changes that we're proposing to policy, the most significant ones are the roles of grazing. Now, the Fish and Wildlife Commission policy currently identifies three broad roles where we might have a grazing permit. Number one would be to manipulate vegetation for fish and wildlife, two, accomplish a specific habitat objective, or three, facilitate coordinated resource management. And we would like to restate those. So instead of manipulating vegetation and some of the connotations associated with that word, we propose to replace it with to manage vegetation for fish and wildlife. We would add a role of grazing to enhance recreational opportunity. We would continue to retain the facilitation of coordinated resource management as a role for grazing, but we're adding context that the reason we do that is to encourage landscape scale conservation. And then we would add a fourth role for grazing, which is to protect community character. We did receive a number of public comments asking for clarification or disagreeing perhaps with the idea of community character. And some of the reasons that those are in there are because the last couple of versions of the strategic plan use that same language about protecting community character. The current strategic plan talks about decision-making that uses social and ecological and economic-based decision-making. So we feel that it's important to have that. And I would add that language talking about why exactly community character is important to conservation and what it means in the context of grazing permits is in the response to comments that we're finalizing. So SEPA does not necessarily require a response to comments. And remember that everything that we've talked about today was reviewed pursuant to the SEPA Act. However, we have chosen to prepare a relatively detailed response to all the comments that we got, and you will have that before your decision. There were two other changes to the commission policy that I wanted to talk about. The first was cross-program review to ensure that best available science guides these permits. So the current commission policy only requires that procedures for cross-program review be developed. So we have those procedures in place, and we think now is the time to change the policy so that those cross-program review procedures are required. So it's not something in the future that we'll develop, it's already in place and it will continue to be required in all cases. And then we would remove some language that's currently in the policy about grazing management plan content. So that paragraph in the policy mostly recapitulates what is already in WAC, but there are a couple of places where it's actually different and less stringent and less conservative. And that doesn't make any sense to us. And so we would keep the language in the WAC that talks about grazing management plans and simply delete this part of the commission policy. So that's a pretty fast overview of the things that are changing that we're actually going to ask for your decision about. The other parts of what we talked about in October, so that's the grazing evaluation framework that you hear about tomorrow, how we work to reduce wolf-livestock conflict, again, we'll touch on that tomorrow. Those are not things that we're asking for a decision from the commission on. What we've talked about today are the two things that we're going to ask for your decision on, and again, that will be on the 12th, and you will have the final text of all those guidelines and tools, the proposed WAC, the proposed policy, and the response to all the comments that we received.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm not seeing hands, so I'm going to ask a couple of very specific questions about the proposed rules. First, it was unclear to me in the first part of the rule, it says something, I don't have it in front of me, but it says something about a person who is interested in grazing on our lands can send a letter to the director. So I was wondering about how that process is envisioned. Say we had an existing wildlife area that had never been grazed, and party was interested in grazing it, they just send a letter and propose it? Or what does that exactly mean in the rule statement?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but usually my understanding is that where the director appears in the text of those things, that can by extension mean a number of different people in the department, whoever has authority. And the reality is that we receive proposals to graze from a variety of different people made to a variety of different staff members. Sometimes it's a wildlife area manager. It's been me. Sometimes it's a regional wildlife program manager. And sometimes it's Cynthia. And one of the reasons why we have the grazing evaluation framework, talking about that tomorrow, is to standardize the process by which we respond to those requests, because it hasn't been uniform, and that is a concern.
Thank you. That's very clarifying. My second question, and I know I've talked to you about this, is the monitoring in the rule. It actually states there will be a twice a year evaluation in the monitoring plan. And you're going to kind of be the monitor, as we've discussed. It seems like quite a bit. Are both of those planned to be on the ground monitoring, or will there be, say, a reporting process for one of them and an on the ground for another?
Yeah, great question. So there are different types of monitoring. The twice annual monitoring will most often consist of compliance monitoring to include utilization. And that is actually typically done by wildlife area staff. That you're right. That's a lot of permits and a lot of wildlife areas, and one person couldn't possibly do an adequate job covering all that. Some of the monitoring that I more personally get involved with is the long-term monitoring, ecological integrity monitoring. We do that at a less frequent interval. But yes, all those events that you talked about that are described in WAC, those would be on the ground.
Thank you. Molly?
My question is on the ability for the department to discontinue grazing without showing, ecological detriments. Is there a time frame set around that? Like how much in advance they need to let the producer know?
Good question. There is not a time frame specified in the proposed WAC language. So one of the things that we had concerns about would be to suspend a permit or even discontinue it indefinitely based on factors that had to be construed as damage. Because existing WAC language allows a permit to be canceled in the event of habitat damage or noncompliance or a certain land use plan stipulation. It may be that we have a logging operation or a prescribed burn operation that necessitates removing grazing for some period of time. And we don't want to be in a situation where we're needing to show that damage to habitat occurred in order to actually accomplish removing those livestock for 2 or 3 or 5 years or whatever it is that might be associated with that restoration action.
So that makes sense to me. I can understand that. I would encourage somewhere, I don't know if it needs to be in the WAC, but I would encourage somewhere that there's some kind of time frame set around that. It would be potentially very, disconcerting. I mean, it could really be hard on the business of a producer if 2 months before they were supposed to turn out on DFW grazing allotments, they were told they couldn't, and finding, land on short notice to put your cattle could be really problematic. So I would just really, I would need to see, some kind of time frame that the producers could depend on if you were going to discontinue the grazing lease.
Thank you, Commissioner Linville. Yeah, there might be language about providing as much notice as possible somewhere. I'd have to hunt it down. But yeah, you're right. To let somebody know 2 months in advance would be a real failing, I think.
Yeah, I couldn't get comfortable with it without so I need assurances around that one. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Molly. Fred?
I don't want to take too much time. So I'll simply say thank you and I'll follow up outside of this meeting The one question that I will be asking you that you might want to just think about is how many of the lands where the grazing occurs were purchased originally by grants? And in those grants, was grazing mentioned, included? And have we circled back with those original grantors and to see their thoughts on the issue? But again, I'll follow up with you later, privately. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Fred. okay, I'm not seeing any. Oh, Lorna, yes.
Just very quickly, Kim, kind of following up on what you were saying about monitoring, what I'm hearing sounds really positive, but then I've been like up in the Klickitat where I have to believe monitoring was not being done because there's barely a stick of vegetation left and cow pies pocketing the landscape, no ungulate, you know, sign to be seen other than, you know, the cattle. So I'm going to need assurances, I guess, that monitoring is actually getting done. And when we find, you know, areas that appear to be overstocked like that, that we have a way to resolve that. So, and I'm open to learning more offline as well. So.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. I think the capability to respond to those situations exists, but I would actually like to follow up with you to talk about the particular location to see if something's going on there that we can fix.
Sure, I've got photos.
Okay.
All right. I'm not seeing anything further. Look forward to the presentation tomorrow. And moving forward, and just want to acknowledge the tremendous amount of work that has gone into this. It's even before our October meeting that this has been before us. It's been a long time coming. I appreciate the careful thought and inspection that's gone into the existing rules and policies and really bringing this together in a much more coherent fashion. Really good work, staff, and important. So still seeing no hands. I think that brings us to the end of our
Hey, Kim, Eric has his hand up.
Yeah, I do see his hand up. I was going to say it brings us to the end of the written agenda. We do have emerging issues on there. And maybe that's what Eric wants to bring up. I'm not sure. But Eric?
Thank you, Commissioner Thorburn. It is maybe slightly different than what you're expecting. My first topic would be, I believe we still have Mick Cope here. There's a topic that's come to the commission in the past about dog aversion training, and we just wanted to kind of daylight that we're, and Mick can speak to this very briefly, but we're on probably a longer timeline path to resolving that particular ask than we had originally anticipated. So I just wanted to give Mick a minute or two to kind of describe where we're at there. And then if you'd like, we could talk a little bit more about future wildlife committee meetings.
Okay. Vic?
Yes, thank you, Eric and commissioners. Just a quick note, because I know it has been brought up and there are folks interested in this dog aversion training. So that is the potential for members of the public to use wildlife, specifically porcupine and rattlesnake, to train dogs to stay away from them. There was a specific ask in front of the commission, and the commission asked the agency to investigate potential rulemaking to allow that. And just wanted to let you know that we are doing our due diligence in looking into that and what kind of rule changes could be needed. There's more work that needs to be done than it would be probably that needs to be done before it could be brought before the commission, because mainly centered around what kind of rules need to be promulgated versus what kinds of things could be put into a permit. And permits and rules are specific, you know, have some ongoing discussions in many different arenas within the agency, and we want to make sure that this is right. So rather than kind of pushing this forward in a short time frame, we want to make sure that you have all of the information in front of you that's necessary to make informed decision on which things should be rules and which things could be okay in a permit. So we'll move that forward and get back to you.
Great. So Mick, when this was presented to us, there were a couple of permit options that were considered, the collection permit and the director's special permission permit. So are you then envisioning a new, completely different permit as a possibility? Because it didn't seem to fit with either of the two existing permits.
Yeah, there's a couple of different issues here, Commissioner. One would be what, you know, which permit to use. It is not a scientific collection permit. It doesn't fit the definitions that are there. It would be a permit from the agency signed by the director to possess wildlife. We do have that kind of in place, but there's also a secondary component that there is a rule that says you can't make money from wildlife. You can't commercialize wildlife. And so that would be a change that would be needed. But then there's also some other components that go along with that permit, or maybe they need to be in rule is what we're trying to figure out. How do you hold the animals? How do you make sure that there's, you know, what level of veterinarian care? How do you address release or not? Some things like that that need to have some time to flesh out the right path forward.
Thank you for that update. things are always a little bit more complicated than they seem on the surface, isn't it?
Aren't they? There's no doubt about that.
So, Eric, do you want to mention, Eric and I had a short conversation this morning about there is a lot more on our plates, and this was, as we can see, a very full agenda. So we have been talking about future meetings, certainly a couple of species hunts have been brought up. And so we are thinking of scheduling another meeting in short order. Eric, do you want to talk about
it a little? Thank you, Commissioner Thorburn. Yeah, I think, you know, one item specifically is, as the commission knows, you know, the department went back in and kind of developed a cougar safety team to kind of look big picture at all of the things kind of connected to the public safety issue and concerns around cougar management and how we respond. That team's been hard at work. We've made quite a bit of progress. We've got information and ideas to report. And just knowing that it's certainly a topic of interest, there's a desire to get to the Wildlife Committee with an update from the Cougar Safety Team, you know, sooner than later. I think it would be good information to share. And so we were thinking that might be one cause to think about having a off cycle. I don't know if that's the right term for it, but a Wildlife Committee meeting sooner than we would normally expect, say trying to get something on our dockets in the next 2 to 3 weeks. That would be in addition to our, you know, regularly scheduled Wildlife Committee meeting.
So, and I would suggest to the committee members, it is a busy time for the wildlife program. As you know, we've got the 3-year packet coming down the road fast. So there will be a lot on our plates in the next few months. So without a lot of objection, we will be looking at scheduling that meeting in the next couple of weeks, probably. I see sober faces after this one meeting.
Yes.
Okay. Anything else emerging for the good of the order? I think we've exhausted everyone. So, good work, Lands Division. And Wildlife Program, thank you. Captain Myers, look forward to hearing from you since you've been working on this e-bike, and we certainly turned to stone on that and see how complicated it is. So you'll be on our agenda in the future. Thank you for sitting in. And with that, still seeing no hands, I'm going to adjourn the meeting. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.